2 days after completing the recording of Ballads of the True West, he smashed June's 1964 Cadillac into a utility pole on South Street in Nashville, causing $2,000 of damage to the car. Police came to the scene, and although he didn't have his driver's license with him, he wasn't charged. They did take him to Vanderbilt Hospital, where he was treated for minor injuries. The official reason given for the accident was heavy rain and a lapse in concentration as he tried to fix a faulty windshield wiper. But as he and everyone around him knew, alcohol and/or drugs were truly to blame. Permanently hyper and incapable of breaking his amphetamine dependency, 33-year-old Cash looked 50, with his drawn face, hollow cheeks, and two great furrows scored from his nose down to the outsides of his mouth. His 155 pounds were distributed over a 6-foot-2-inch frame, making him look alarmingly thin. He had been 5 pounds heavier at the age of 18. He had developed a number of nervous habits often imitated by people on the country scene, scratching his neck, the nervous cough, the twisting of his head. Chris Christopherson, then serving in the Army, first met Cash at the Opry in 1965. "He looked like a panther pacing around backstage," he says. "He was so skinny and wired out." Cash's condition began seriously affecting his career. "Many times we'd have to go ahead and do the show without him just to try and save whatever the box office had taken," says Don Reed of the Statler Brothers. "We just had to walk out on stage and say, 'Ladies and gentlemen, Johnny Cash is not here this evening. Anybody who wants their money back can go to the box office now, but the rest of us are here and we'll put on a show. We hope that you'll stay and that you'll enjoy it.'" Surprisingly, a lot would stay. At other times, Cash would perform, but in such an agitated state that everyone would be on tenterhooks. At the Grand Ole Opry in 1965, he lost his temper on stage, either because he couldn't dislodge a microphone from its stand or because he found the stage lights too bright. His tantrum resulted in his banishment from the Opry. "What I remember is that he dragged his microphone stand right across the footlights so that he'd take them out," says Don Reed. "It was because of the pills. It was the pills talking. He would do really bizarre things. I've seen him stop in the middle of a concert and take a microphone apart with a screwdriver while the audience sat there waiting for him to carry on. All of a sudden, right in the middle of the show, that microphone became the most important thing in his life. We were all standing there waiting for him. These strange urges would come over him." These distractions could sometimes cost him days. He would drive to the desert for an afternoon and not come back for a week. Once, on the way home to Los Angeles from Nashville, he found himself partying in Dallas with people he didn't even know. "In 1965, he lost my Cadillac," remembers Johnny Western. "He was on an amphetamine jag. He had flown to California to do a TV show with me and ask if he could borrow my car for a couple of hours. The next day at around 9 a.m., I had a call from a rather sheepish Johnny who said that, he'd been up all night on pills and couldn't remember where he'd left it. It was later found outside the farmer's market with a dead battery and the keys in the ignition." The show he had flown in to do was Shindig, produced by Jack Good, who had introduced him to British television in 1959 on Boy Meets Girl. Good recalls that Cash was on pills when he first met him in Manchester, England, but that by 1965 he was barely controllable. "It took them 2 hours to tape one song because Cash couldn't remember the words. We introduced him as being in his famous role as Harry the Hobo, but I think that was put in to disguise his strange behavior," says Good. "We also had to bring some dancers on so that we had somewhere to go if he was really out of it." When he was working in Nashville, he'd stay with Gene Ferguson and his family, but there were times when Cash's behavior was so unacceptable that Ferguson would make him stay in his office downtown. "When he was staying with me, he'd sometimes take a ballpoint pen and write phone numbers on my couch," he says. "He'd go out in the rain with no shoes or socks on, and in the morning, there'd be mud right through the house. There were a couple of times when I went to wake him when he didn't respond and I couldn't feel a heartbeat. Once I called Luther to ask him what I should do, and Luther said, 'Well, he'll either wake up or die.' That was the answer I got." Today, such escapades would be widely reported and there would be public concern about his state of mind, but in 1965, as far as his fans knew, Johnny Cash was a happily married Christian who sometimes suffered from laryngitis. For Saul Holliff, who had had no previous experience of dealing with addictive personalities, his client's erratic behavior gave him quite a headache. "I was brought up in a rational, non-religious, open-minded household of logic," he says. "Suddenly I found myself in this chaotic, unpredictable, terrible atmosphere. Nothing could be finalized. Nothing could be definite. The cancellations were awful, and I had to handle them and make good on them. I had to fend off lawsuits. There was never a tranquil period that lasted for more than a week. Cash's drug-impaired ability to react quickly started to threaten his safety. He crashed cars and rolled them down banks. He sank a boat. He overturned a tractor on his land in Casita Springs. In June 1965, while fishing in the Los Padres National Forest, he stalled his camper in the sand on the edge of the creek, and as he revved the engine, the heat from the exhaust pipe set the grass on fire. He attempted to put it out, but the fire spread rapidly and eventually raised 508 acres, which were a significant habitat of near-extinct California condors. It took 450 firefighters to put out the blaze. In an unprecedented case, the federal government sued Cash for $125,127. He contested the figure and 2 years later settled for $82,000. Things finally came to a head. On October 2, 1965, Cash played a show in Dallas, but instead of staying overnight, as expected, he checked out of his hotel and flew to El Paso, Texas, from where he took a cab across the Rio Grande to Juarez, Mexico. There, he'd been told, was a thriving black market in pills. From a Mexican dealer, he bought 475 Equinil and 668 Dexedrine tablets, which he then hid inside a guitar. He returned to El Paso International Airport and waited for a plane home to Los Angeles. However, the dealer in Juarez had been under surveillance because he was believed to be selling heroin. Federal customs agents promptly arrested Cash and locked him up overnight in the county jail. The next day, dressed in a black suit and a white open-neck shirt, he appeared in court at a bond hearing where he faced U.S. Commissioner Colbert Cowell. Cash was charged with willfully smuggling and concealing drugs after importation, ordered not to leave the continental United States until further notice, and released on a $1,500 bond. After the hearing, he left the court flanked by two plainclothes policemen, his wrists cuffed together in front of him. A press photographer pointed his camera at him, and Cash kicked out in anger, but not before the shutter clicked. The next day, a photograph of the handcuffed Cash in dark glasses appeared in newspapers across the country. "It was on the front page of our local newspaper in Casita Springs," says Cindy Cash. "I remember being terrified that my friends would see it." 2 months later, accompanied by Vivian, and with moral support from Don Law and Floyd Gressett, Cash returned to El Paso to plead guilty to the possession of illegal drugs. The misdemeanor criminal offense carried a maximum $1,000 fine, 1 year in prison, or both. The district judge deferred sentencing indefinitely, pending a report from his probation officer. When Cash left the court that day, he was again photographed, this time without dark glasses, wearing a suit and tie, and holding hands with Vivian. The picture that ran in papers the next day made Vivian's full lips and Mediterranean complexion resemble those of a light-skinned African-American. For some reason, the Ku Klux Klan picked up on it and published the photograph in their paper Thunderbolt, as well as on flyers. They described Vivian as a negress, Cash as scum, and their four children as mongrelized. The Klan also ran advertisements in newspapers across the South, saying, "For Cash, call this number." The listed number connected to a recorded message warning people not to attend Johnny Cash concerts because the singer was married to a nigger woman. Johnny was unaware of the KKK campaign until Porter Wagner called him about a flyer he saw while playing in Ponchatoula, Louisiana. Cash hired a top lawyer for the case, John J. Hooker, and filed a $25 million lawsuit against the Klan. Cash released an official statement.